for tonight is June G, and here she is.
Hi, my name is June Guinan, and I'm an alcoholic and a pill addict.
Hi, June.
Hi. It feels great to be here. I'm very honored to be invited here. I particularly want to thank Marcia and Michael and Brooke and Tom for inviting me and the rest of the committee. I love Alcoholics Anonymous very much. I've never been here or to either Oregon or Washington, and it's a real privilege. I live in exile, and this one. Okay, thank you. And I love it there. I'd like you all to know that in exile it was sunny and 78 degrees today. And tomorrow afternoon I'll be wearing my bathing suit and playing baseball while you guys sit inside here with your fur coats. So there are things to be said about living in exile. We have we've had a lot more exciting things happen. No volcanic eruptions, but we have a lot of fun down there. I think that this conference is just wonderful. And you know, I'm always real impressed, and it strikes me as very strange the way this hits me, but you know, I got sober in Los Angeles, I'm active in Los Angeles and in Alcoholics Anonymous there, and sometimes I just get to thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous is in Los Angeles, and you know, there's a few people out there somewhere, and they invite Chuck C. from Los Angeles to come talk, and that's about all that there is out there in the world. And, you know, being here tonight and seeing this and attending some of the meetings here this afternoon, it's just fascinating. You know, this afternoon I was sitting in these meetings and there were a bunch of people who I'd never met or seen before, and they were talking and saying the same things that they're saying in the meetings back home. It's just incredible. It's really neat. There's a special language here in Alcoholics Anonymous that only people in this program know. I guess I've been given a lot of gifts, too, since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the greatest gifts I've been given is a sense of humor. I don't know about any of you, but when I came to this program, I didn't think anything was funny, ever. And particularly if it had to do with me and my life, you know. And today, I really don't I don't feel that way at all. And the thing, too, that I've learned is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I've learned to be able to share where I've been, what I've done, what I've felt, and not be ashamed of it. And that's a very unusual thing, I suppose, in many areas outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are many people who never experience anything like that. And because I'm so close in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this has been a part of my life for so long, I oftentimes forget that when I'm out there in the world dealing with normal people. And I had an experience roughly a year ago that kind of explained to me that Alcoholics Anonymous is a little different in that it's more free from judgment than a lot of other places might be. I was talking to a guy at school, and he said, we were talking about movies. In particular, we were talking about a film called The Rose. And The Rose was supposed to be, he was explaining to me, the story of Janis Joplin's life. And I had kind of heard that. I had just recently seen the film. And he asked, we were talking about it. And he said, you know, I've always idolized Janis Joplin. And I said, really? He didn't strike me as the type of person that would, you know, idolize Janis Joplin. And that was kind of surprising. And he said, you know, there's something about that movie, though, that really bothered me. And I said, what was that? And he said, well, there's a part in the movie towards the beginning, maybe about the middle, and she's about to have an affair with this man. And she says to him right before, she says, you know, I have a confession to make. She said, I slept with everyone on the high school football team. And then they go on and have their affair, and the movie continues. Now, he said to me, he said, you know, if that's true, you know, if Janis Joplin really did that, he said, I just don't think I could respect and idolize her anymore. And I looked at him and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And I knew immediately that this was somebody I should never tell my story to. I identified myself as an alcoholic and a pill addict this evening. And the primary reason for that is not to impress you with what a cool dope fiend I was. It's very simply to explain that that was an addiction that I also had. And when I'm asked to share, I think that I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope. And for me, my experience includes the use of alcohol and chemicals, because I very rarely used one without the other. That seemed to be the combination that worked the best for me. And, you know, I remember when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, for the first couple of years, you know, they used to really get crazy if I'd talk about pills. And, you know, and they'd come up to me and they'd tell me, you know, about it. And at first I started to listen to them, you know, and I started to think, gee, you know, maybe they're right. And then I came to notice that the only people who ever complained about my talking about pills were the ones who were still taking them. I think that Alcoholics Anonymous is a very, very special place. In school sometimes, you know, there are certain groups and cliques and a lot of elitism I see. And it's very strange to me, actually, because I'm not used to anything like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, generally in the meetings I go to, the speaker could be from Skid Row or Beverly Hills, and they're going to be loved and respected and admired just as much. It really doesn't matter. And really, that's the way I've been brought up, you know. And so in school, sometimes to see people judged for different reasons like that are very strange. I mean, for one thing, one time they were trying to decide, it was like a philosophical discussion. And they said, if you could only save one person, would you save the Skid Row bum or would you save the businessman in the three-piece suit? And I was the only person in the class who voted for the Skid Row bum. I mean, everybody else wanted to save, you know, the guy in the three-piece suit. I think, though, that Alcoholics Anonymous, just like a lot of other organizations, had to go through a period of time where they had to consider whether they were going to be any kind of an elitist organization, who they were going to let in or not. And that's why, I guess, for me, the 12 traditions are so special, the way that they've suggested that Alcoholics Anonymous continue as a group. I'm particularly grateful for the third tradition, which states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I thought tonight I'd like to read you a little part of how they were thinking when Alcoholics Anonymous was first starting and they were eventually deciding to write that third tradition. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So, beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? We built a fine mesh fence right around AA. Interestingly enough, as I read that list, and I think about it every time I read it, that includes all of my closest friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And probably many of yours, too. And so I'm real grateful they included that tradition. It gives anybody the freedom to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous who has a desire to stop drinking, regardless of their color, their race, their age, or their background or social status. And that's been a very important part of my sobriety and my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess before I can really talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, or should, I should talk a little bit about what it used to be like. I think that I was born an alcoholic, and I don't care to get into any philosophical discussions about it. It's something that I'm comfortable with and I believe. And the main reason for that was that long before I ever put any kind of alcohol into my body, there was something that was very wrong with me. And the way that it first manifested itself was in the form of suicide, and that became my first obsession. And at the age of 5 years old, I began to try and take my life on a regular basis. I started at that time to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades. I started to beat my face with a hammer. I started to do a lot of destructive things to try and hurt myself. Somewhere in that time, I was taking overdoses of baby aspirin. I hadn't found anything else yet. And basically, you know, I don't have a real clear idea of why my behavior was that way. I've been to a lot of psychiatrists, but I've never told them anything. I always thought they should work for their money. But I think, you know, that really what it was that for whatever reason, I never liked myself. Oftentimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've heard people share about the fact that as they drank and perhaps used some other chemicals, they lost their self-worth and they lost their self-respect. And to tell you the truth, I've never been able to identify with that because I had no idea what either one of those words meant until after I'd come into Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that I've ever known was a lot of self-hatred. And really, I don't know why, but that's the only feeling that I ever had. There was never one moment in my entire life that I can remember where I liked being me, where I wanted to look like me, where I wanted to be living the life I was living. And most of all, there was never one second where I wanted to be feeling the way that I was feeling. As I grew up, I was a great observer of people. And the thing that I noticed right away was that men and women reacted in vastly different ways to the exact same situations. And in my life, up until the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I never saw a man express any emotion except for anger or rage. I never saw a man cry. I never saw a man admit that his feelings had been hurt, no matter what the situation, whether his daughter died, whether his wife left him, whether anything. Nothing ever seemed to move any man that I ever knew in my life as I grew up. And on the other hand, I saw these women dealing with the same situation, and I saw many of them react with anger and rage and violence, but I also saw some of them cry, and I saw the pain that they felt, and I saw even some of them have nervous breakdowns. And as I looked at these two different groups of people, I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my entire life trying to be what I thought a man was. And I have to tell you, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous still acting in that way, and I had a very warped idea of what a man was. I thought that a man felt nothing, ever, that nobody could ever hurt them, and that only thing that you could do was to make them angry and want to hit you. And that's how I wanted to be all my life. I just wanted nobody to get near me. I didn't want anybody to be able to hurt me. I didn't want anybody to matter. I just wanted to not care at all. And I guess the reason that that was so important to me was that I seemed to care just too damn much. I remember, you know, going to school and somebody would call me a name and I remember it would just rip inside of me. And I learned right then, all my life, I would much rather tolerate any kind of physical pain than even the least bit of emotional pain. And I spent my life trying to get my face punched in rather than have anybody emotionally get near me. And that's really what I did. I got my face punched in a lot, and that was fine with me. I just didn't want to be hurt emotionally. And the reason was, you know, I thought that to feel anything and to let people hurt your feelings was weak. And in my life, nothing ever made me as disgusted or hateful as the thought that somebody was weak. And I suppose to a great extent that's why I felt the way I did about myself, because I thought that I was weak, because I cared and because I felt things, and I hated that about myself and I thought I was disgusting. I found drugs when I was 7 years old. Within a little over a year, I found the combination that worked for me, and that was alcohol and barbiturates, or reds, or yellows, or downers, whatever you might know them as. And I very rarely used one without the other. I needed the combined effect. Unlike many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't out there to party. I didn't drink or use drugs to feel good. I drank and used drugs so I didn't have to feel anything at all. I just wanted out. I really wanted to die. There wasn't a day in my life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't pray to die or try and inflict an overdose upon myself or do something to get myself killed. Not one day. I really wanted out. I never wanted to live, and I never wanted to feel anything. And I'm very grateful that I found alcohol and drugs when I did, because I don't believe that, I'm not sure whether I'd be dead, but I'm positive I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of a little rubber room, because there was no way I could tolerate the feelings that I felt, the intensity of the pain that I felt and the hatred that I felt for myself. I had to have alcohol and drugs just to shut down just a little bit, just to get a little bit of relief. And as I grew up, you know, the only people that I ever associated with were primarily men. There were a few tough broads in my life, which was who I tried to emulate. You know, when I was a little kid and they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to be a man. And they told me I couldn't because it wasn't as easy back then as it is now. But that's true. That's really what I wanted to be. And so I only associated with men. Most of what my idea of a man was somebody who was violent, somebody who was hostile, somebody who had tattoos, carried weapons, had done time. And those were the people that I associated with and admired. I never admired anybody who I thought was kind or decent. I never wanted to be a lady. I would have rather been a prostitute. I had no desire ever for anything that was respectable or what society said should be. I never wanted any part of anything that life had to offer. I'm real, you know, it's funny. Recently, the last few years, my girlfriends, several of them have gotten tattoos, you know, and tattoos in California anyway have been real popular for women in the last few years. And mainly they get things, you know, like little panda bears and flowers and butterflies and all these, you know, cute little things, you know, that you might think women would get. And I'm just grateful tattoos weren't in when I was on the street. I mean, I'd be standing up here tonight, I'd have a shark on my arm. And it would swim when I did this. You know? And I'd probably have a battleship on my chest. You know? Or maybe a canoe in my case, but that's not that funny. Thank you. I was willing to go to any lengths to be tough. I'll tell you about one of my last experiences. I had a gang of tough broads that I ran with, five of them. And they stopped by my house one night and they said, look, if you come out of the house tomorrow, we're going to beat you up. Now, I got up the next morning, I immediately got dressed, and I immediately walked out of the house because I didn't want anybody to think I was afraid of them. I didn't want them to think that I was sitting in that house, scared to come out. I didn't want anybody to ever think they could scare me. And so I came outside. As soon as I walked outside of my door, they started to follow me down the street. Now I'm walking down the street and these five girls are following me. And I know they want to beat me up. Now I'm walking down a street and I have a choice of staying on the street or taking the alley. And I thought about this and I thought, if I don't take the alley, they're going to think I'm afraid to take that alley. And I don't want anybody thinking I'm afraid to do nothing. So I took the alley and they beat me up. Now, for whatever reason, I was laying in the alley. They're knocking my head against the asphalt and punching me in the face. And all they wanted was for me to cry. And I really don't know what the reason was why they'd chosen that, but that's all they wanted. And I didn't cry. Not one single tear. And I don't know how long they punched my face. You know, time's kind of gone when things like that are happening. It's hard to keep track. But they finally got bored and left. And when I got up with my black eye, my swollen lip, blood running all over my face, if you'd asked me, I'd have said I won. Because I didn't cry. I didn't give them what they wanted. I didn't let them know that they could get to me. And that was more important to me than anything in the world. I would have died that day if they'd have chose to continue to hit me that long. Now, that seems really rather absurd to me tonight. Didn't then. It was my way of life. But tonight it really does. I mean, if somebody walked up to me and they said, look, June, I'm going to punch you in the face, or you can cry a couple tears. I'd say, oh, it's a big deal. I'll cry a couple tears, you know. But at this particular time, my whole life seemed to count on my image and what people thought, and if people thought they could get to me, I just couldn't handle it. I was raised by an alcoholic, And so I knew a lot about alcoholism firsthand. My mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous since I was 6 years old. So I knew, too, about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only person I've ever hated almost as much as myself was her, because I thought she was weak and disgusting. There was a lot of violence in our lives that she subjected herself and me to, and I never respected her for that. I never respected her primarily because I thought that she was weak, because I'd seen her cry and I'd seen her hurt and I'd seen her feel pain, and I just couldn't tolerate that in anybody. And she brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and really it wasn't particularly because she thought I had a problem. I hadn't spent very much time around my mother. I'd been on my own or in and out of several foster homes by this time, and she really didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't particularly care to let her know. But she did bring me to a meeting, and at the meeting that night, the miracle of this program started to happen for me, as I see it. There was somebody there, this guy, and I used to drink and use drugs with him, just a little bit. But the thing about this man was that there was nobody in the whole world that I admired more. As a matter of fact, there wasn't anybody in the neighborhood that I admired more. He was just incredible. He had tattoos. He'd been in a lot of prisons. He still carried a knife. He'd been a heroin addict, or was still. And he was tough. God, he was so tough. And I just admired this man more than anybody in the whole world. And here he was in AA. I was just very impressed. And I talked to him all that evening, you know, and then the next night I went out and I got drunk. And then I came back to some meetings, and mainly to see this guy, because he was my idol. I mean, I just always idolized this guy. I couldn't believe it, you know. And I continued to drink and use, I think, during this two-week period of time, and I hung around him, and I went to a lot of meetings because that's where he was going every night. And I spent a lot of time trying to convince him that I wasn't an alcoholic. He never said anything one way or another, but I spent a lot of time trying to tell him, you know, I couldn't be, you know, I'm too young, and, you know, there's all these reasons. And I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time convincing people that they're not alcoholics. And one day he finally turned to me and he said, you know what, June? He said, they tell us in Alcoholics Anonymous that we can only diagnose our own disease. So, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I happen to believe you're an alcoholic. And he said, I believe that because I've seen you drink and I've seen the way that you use drugs. He said, I also believe that if you don't come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He certainly wasn't talking about the horrible road of alcoholism like some high school teacher threatening me. He was stating facts, plain and simple, some things that I'd already done and knew about. And I thought a little bit about what he said, and then I thought, oh, no, I'm too young. I've got places to go, things to see. I've got my whole life ahead of me. And then absolutely everything was removed so that there was no choice but Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother and I had a very volatile relationship because, as I've already told you, how much I hated her. And I was very violent, particularly towards her, and I attacked her frequently. And she didn't feel that she had to subject herself to that, and so she asked me to leave her home, and I did. My family hadn't spoken to me in a couple of years that time and didn't want to start. I wasn't allowed to call their home ever, or come near their children or their house. And I didn't. I'd been in several foster homes up to that point. I'd been asked to leave all of them. None of them would consider taking me back. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes in Los Angeles, and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some simply because of my attitude. I already told you what happened to my five best friends and I. And so... I only had one alternative, as I thought, and that was suicide. That was always my alternative. And so I went over to a friend of my mother's, and I went into the ladies' bathroom, first place I went at anybody's house, find out what kind of pills they had. And I found the kind that I needed, and I took an overdose on purpose. And then the second part of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened, because that was in the daytime, and I went to a noon meeting. And I stumbled into the meeting, and I laid down. And I think the miracle, again, was working in my life, because I don't know about up here in Washington, but in Los Angeles, where I got sober, we very rarely call on people to talk who are laying in the meeting. And they asked me to talk. I have not the foggiest idea of what I said. But I know that I must have told them I'd taken the overdose, and I was, or what I'd taken, or something. And I woke up the next time I woke up, I was in a hospital, and I was being given medication by a doctor to make me throw up these pills. And he was explaining to me that pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I gotten there maybe 5 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And as I stand here tonight, I honestly can't tell you why that's any different than any other overdose that I inflicted upon myself. I really don't know. I just know that it was. Because since then, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything. And this past July, I celebrated my 9th anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. During that first 2 weeks, before I was even sober, I suppose that's when the importance of that third tradition was grounded into me. Because what happened was, I was very young, and there were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who thought that I was too young. And some of them asked me to leave their meetings, because they didn't think that anybody my age should be in a meeting. And I, of course, took that to mean that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. And those people obviously didn't know anything about the traditions, which I think are so important. And what I think I said that day in that meeting, and it's real important, I think, for me to try and remember to say it, was I think I said, you know what, I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone just a little bit farther than some of you. I don't really think that's very important. Because the point is, I don't have any place left to go. And I don't know if I want what you people have. I don't even know what you have. I just know I can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me if I go back out there on the streets I'm going to die. Because dying doesn't scare me. Not one goddamn bit. Dying's what I've been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live for another 20 or 30 years, like some of you people have. And that's what I can't stand, is living out there that way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And there were still a lot of people who thought I was too young, you know. There were still people who came up to me after meetings and they'd say, you know, kid, I spilt more booze on my tie than you ever drank. And I just turned to them and said, you know, if you hadn't spilt so much, maybe you would have gotten here sooner. And for people who came into the program like me, I'm particularly grateful for those people who were here when I got here and for those people who tolerated me. And I choose the word tolerate very carefully rather than love. I'd like to give you a little bit of an idea of how I came to this program. I walked into the program as tall as I am now. I was 87 pounds. I had my black eye, my swollen lip, my blue jeans. I never wore shoes. I didn't have any. Wouldn't have worn them if I did. I had t-shirts that said things on them that people found very offensive, which is why I wore them. I had a motorcycle chain around my wrist. I had a motorcycle jacket that I wore on the back of it that said, do unto others and then split. I went to meetings where they didn't allow profanity, and I used it. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I also smoked cigars and a pipe. And the reason for this behavior was I wanted to keep people away. And I'd like to assure you that if you choose to act that way in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a good chance you'll be able to keep people away. In fact, there were times I could sit in a meeting and have an entire row all to myself. I talked to one guy not too long ago, maybe a year or so now, and I said, you know, Jim, you haven't talked to me since we were new and got sober together. And he says, don't you know why? And I said, gee, I really don't. He said, well, one night, whole gang of us went to a meeting, and then we all went to coffee afterwards. And he said, I said something at the coffee shop you didn't like, and you put your cigarette out in my shirt. And he said, and then on the way home, you slammed the car door on my head. And I don't remember doing that. I'm sure all I was trying to do was let him know I liked him, you know. Because where I came from, that's what you did. I mean, if you liked somebody, you punched them, you know. If you really liked them, you punched them harder. I mean, that was the only form of communication I knew when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, was, you know, violence or verbal abuse. I'd never given a compliment in my life. The closest thing to a compliment I ever gave was, that was a good fight. So, it's the only nice thing I ever said in my life. I had worked years at trying to perfect being able to tear people apart verbally. That was something I greatly admired, almost as much as, you know, physical abilities. And of course, I didn't realize when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that I was amongst a group of experts at that. I found a sponsor, and he was more hostile than I was. And when I would get out of hand, he would grab me around the neck and threaten to kill me. And I know it doesn't say that anywhere in the big book, but I understood that. Jeez. We used to have some real knockdown, drag-out fights in meetings. It was pretty funny. Anyway, we both stayed. I was thinking, you know, I've learned so much from my sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had quite a few. As a matter of fact, my first year, I just had millions. Because if I liked somebody, I'd ask them to be my sponsor, because I didn't know any other way to tell them that I liked them. I couldn't just say, I like you. I mean, come on, you know, I'm from the streets, I'm cool, you don't do that. I didn't tell anybody I liked them until I'd been sober over 5 or 6 years, I think, you know, but I could ask them to be my sponsor and then not do what they said, and that seemed to be about the best I could do as far as any kind of a friendship. My sponsor, though, he told me that it was very important that I get the big book. And I'd been a thief all my life. And I didn't see any reason to change that much here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at my home group, even, they said, you know, if you don't have the money to buy the book and you're too afraid to talk to us about credit arrangements, steal it. And I thought I would. So I thought about this, though, and I kind of thought if I stole the big book from an AA meeting, it would jinx my sobriety. So I went to the library in Santa Monica, and I stole the big book. And while I was there, I picked up a copy of the 12 and 12. No sense making two trips. I never felt bad about that. Library have lots of books. And that's the way I always felt about stealing. You know, I felt very little guilt about the things that I had stolen in my life, because I always thought they had more than I did and I deserved it. And I thought if they were stupid enough to let me in someplace, they deserved to be stolen from. I remember I worked a couple of years ago. I haven't talked about this in a long time. A couple years ago as an elf for Santa Claus. God, nobody from the neighborhood dropped by. They wouldn't have believed it. Long way from the motorcycle chains to this little red dress with fur. And I was the manager, and I had more fur around my dress, I guess that's how you could tell, and I was in charge of making deposits. And I made a deposit, like $1,000, into a vault. And then the other manager was picking it up in the morning and would deposit it into the bank. And because I was on the night shift. Anyway, they called me up the next morning and they said, where'd you put the money? I said, I put it in the vault. And they said, it's not there. There's $1,000 missing. You're kidding. I said, no. So I just, you know, they hung up, and I just was hysterical. Did I steal it? I didn't think I did, but I'd stolen so many times all my life. I thought, you know, maybe I had, and I didn't remember. And I thought, no, I know I didn't, you know. And they asked me if I'd take a lie detector test, and I said, okay. So I went down there, and they started the test, and he hooked me up, and he said, okay. He said, have you ever abused any kinds of drugs or alcohol? And I said, wait a minute. Wait, we got to start, you know, from the beginning here. I said, that's not a good question. And he said, okay, all right. He said, have you ever stolen anything from somebody who's trusted you? I thought, I'm going to jail. There's no way I'm going to pass this test, you know. I said, wait a minute. I said, can we take these wires off? I want to tell you my story. Anyway, I passed the test, but still a little wreckage there, I suppose. When I'd been sober a few years, I realized that I wasn't comfortable with the fact that I'd stolen the big book. And I wanted to take it back, and I wanted to take the other 50 library books I had in the closet back too. I'd been stealing library books since I was about 6 years old, and I had great classics like Misty the Seahorse and things like that. And I loaded them up, and I was going to take them down to the library. And I'd never told my sponsor that I was a library book thief. Because it was too low. I mean, if I'd have robbed a bank, everybody would have known, you know. I'd have been thrilled to talk about it. But stealing library books, you know, and I knew I was going to get busted, you know. And I just couldn't believe that was going to go on my record. I just couldn't believe it. I could hear the judge now, you know, admonishing me, saying, "Do you know how many children never got to read Misty the Seahorse?" You know, I couldn't deal with it. But after I'd been sober, I was just so uncomfortable. I loaded all these books down, and I took them down to the local librarian, knowing that nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous had ever sunk that low. And I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was necessary for my sobriety to return the books, and I'd like to make payments because they want 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books 11 years. And she said, "Well, that's fine." She said, "You know, it's very funny that you said that, though." She said, "I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach, and this man came in, and he said the same thing you just said. He'd had that book 35 years. She said, "You guys must do this all the time." And what I found out was that there really isn't anything that I've done or thought about doing in Alcoholics Anonymous that hasn't already been done, or at least somebody's thought about doing it. I got real active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. I got a home group. I became literature chairperson there. I went to most every meeting that I went to early, and I helped set it up, and I stayed late and helped tear it down. And I went to a couple meetings a day. I went to 21 meetings a week, a good part of my first year. And after the meeting, after I'd helped tear it down, I went to coffee with the people who were going to stay out the latest, and then I'd go home and make up a problem and call my sponsor and test him. And really, I didn't do any of those things because I was wonderful or even because I was gung-ho AA. It was basically because I was terrified. I suddenly, upon getting sober, had the feeling that AA could not work for me. You know, I came into this program and I wasn't nearly as bad of shape physically as many people that I've seen come in since I've been here. But mentally, I was amongst the best of them, you know. I was a greeter at a Tuesday night meeting, and I'd stand at the door. Somebody'd come up and say, "Hi, I'm Sally," and I'd say, "Hi, I'm June." And I'd shake hands, and then somebody else would come up and say, "Hi, I'm Mary," and I'd say, "Hi, I'm Sally." You know, I was... Whatever I'd heard last was all that was there, you know. And I'd be tied, be in the middle of a conversation, and I'd just zone out, you know. And I couldn't for the life of me remember what I was trying to say. And I'd read the big book. I'd read the same sentence over and over and over. And there were no big words, you know. And I couldn't remember. I mean, if you'd asked me 3 seconds later, I couldn't remember what the goddamn thing said, you know. And I sat there and I thought, I don't know if my mind is ever going to come back. And a lot of my friends still don't think it has, but it certainly has improved. I got a job. And it was a great job for me. I worked as a PBX operator. In an answering service, answering phones. And it was a great job because I could work it so that I could go to lots of meetings, and I could work my schedule around that. And it was a fascinating thing to me that I was not fired, because I've already given you some idea of my attitude, and many people would have termed me hostile. And I'd answer the phone, and if they weren't nice to me, I'd just hang up on them. You know, I didn't feel like I had to take that. And I really can't believe they didn't fire me, but for some reason they didn't, and I worked there for quite a while. And I sat there one day thinking, which, as Lynn was saying, is not really a good thing for me to do. You know, I oftentimes think that's what I need to do, which is when I should definitely call somebody right away. But I was thinking, it was kind of slow at work, and I sat there thinking. I thought about the one day at a time aspect of this program, and you know, I'm one of those people in Alcoholics Anonymous that can take one of the most positive things and just make it depressing as hell, you know. And I looked at the fact that this was a one day at a time program and that I was going to have to work one day at a time for the next 65 years of my life at that job for the same money. And I was depressed. And I called my sponsor and I told him, do you know I have to work one day at a time for the next 65 years of my life? Do you know how long that is? You know? And he said, why don't you just finish today? And we'll talk about this later. And really what I was finding out was that that wasn't what I wanted to do the rest of my life. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a 7th grade education. And I was not willing or able, really. I'm not sure which it was most of, to go back to school. And I didn't. And at this particular period of time, after I'd been sober a while, I was given an opportunity to go to a business college and learn how to be a secretary. In my entire life, there's nothing I've ever wanted to be less than a secretary. I mean, it was just not too cool. However, I didn't want to work as a BBX operator the rest of my life either, so I went down and I signed up for this class, and I started taking all these secretarial courses, and I did pretty good at most things. You know, I hadn't been in school in a long time, but I seemed to pick things up pretty quick, except for typing. And do you want the water? Do you want the water?
Please.
Okay. I, sure. I had a little trouble with typing. I was typing, when I got there, I was typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. And after 14 months of typing one day at a time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And, they told me I was just never going to be a secretary. And they suggested that before I try and get a job, I go ahead and take a test, which would give me an equivalent to a high school diploma. So I went down and I signed up for this test, and it's on the 5 different areas that you learn about if you've gone to high school. And I took the first 4 parts, and they were pretty cool. And the 5th part was math. And I thought they'd start out with addition and subtraction, which is all I've ever had. And they started out with algebra. And then they started doing things I couldn't even pronounce. I just couldn't believe this test. They had a rectangle with a line drawn across it, so it had 2 triangles in there. And they wanted to know how many feet were in one of those triangles. I started drawing little pictures of feet. I swear to God, I have no better idea tonight how the hell you're supposed to do that than I did then. Fortunately for me, the answers on this test were already picked out, you know, and you just picked A, B, C, or D. So I closed the test and I decided to talk to God. This is a good time for spiritual contact. And I was at the bargain stage of my sobriety. I said, look, God, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go through this test, and I'm going to pick lots of A's, you know, for AA. Seemed like a good idea at the time, and I said, and I hope you know your math. And that's what I did, and I'd like all of you to know here tonight that God's as bad at math as he is at typing. But somehow I managed to pass the test. And now began one of the first real difficult periods that I'd had in my sobriety. In part, the reason that it was so important to me to keep people away in Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly physically, I didn't like anybody to shake my hand or to give me a hug or a kiss or even to hold my door open for me. You know, I didn't like anybody doing anything for me or getting near me at all. And I was quite firm about it. And most people took me for my word. You know, I really didn't like it. And the reason for that was really the way I felt about myself. You know, I already told you that from as far back as I can remember, I never liked anything about myself. And that never got any better, not in the least bit. As a matter of fact, it got increasingly worse the longer that I was out there and the longer that I drank and used drugs and the things that all of us, I suppose, do while we're out there. And upon getting sober, I was no longer so proud of what a cool, tough broad I'd been and of all the people that I'd manipulated and taken advantage of and used physically and otherwise. It no longer seemed like such a cool thing to have done. And I wasn't very happy about it anymore, and I really hated myself. And I knew exactly what I was upon getting sober. I was a dirty little Venice broad. That's all I'd ever been. That's all I was ever going to be. And there wasn't anything about Alcoholics Anonymous that could change that. Because Alcoholics Anonymous could never change where I'd been and what I'd done and who I was, ever. And I knew that. I decided to stay sober anyway. I came to this program, though, and I didn't take baths or showers, and I had it for a long time before I got here, because I didn't want to get that close to myself, because I felt like if I had to touch my arm just to wash myself, I'd throw up, because I was just disgusted at what I was, and I was one of the few people who knew what I was, and I didn't want to be me, especially now that I was sober. I just didn't want to be me. And those feelings, I know that for some people they get better very quickly. I hung on to, I suppose, or at least they lasted for an awful long time. And upon finishing this course and being a secretary or somebody qualified or semi-so to work in an office, none of these feelings had really left. And now for the first time in my life I had to go out there and I had to look for a job in the citizen-y type, you know, field. I didn't know how to dress. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew nothing. I was an animal, and I knew a lot about survival, but I knew nothing. Nobody had ever told me how often you should wash your hair or take showers or when you're supposed to brush your teeth or anything like that. Nobody had ever told me anything. It just wasn't something that we talked about much, and I didn't know. And the only thing I had were T-shirts and sweatshirts and jeans, and I'd never worn anything else, and basically. And so they, some people in the program took me out and help me get some clothes so I could dress up like a secretary. And to me, it was like Halloween, you know? It's like, look at the little Venice bride dressed up like a secretary. You know, I knew I wasn't a secretary. I was a little Venice bride in these clothes, you know? And as far as I could tell, these people knew that too. And the hardest thing I had to do up to that point was to walk into these offices and shake hands with these people who I knew were so much better than I was, who had nice carpets and air conditioning and nice respectable families and homes. And I knew I wasn't good enough to work where they were or to shake their hands or even to look in their eyes, and I couldn't. But I kept going on these interviews anyway, you know, and I ended up getting a job, and I couldn't believe it. I got a job in an insurance company. I mean, that's so square. I couldn't believe it, you know. And I went to work, and I worked as hard as I could, you know. And on the seventh day, they called me in the office, and by this time, I thought they were going to give me a raise. And they fired me. She said, I'm sorry, you don't have enough experience. And she said, not only that, dear, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. And I didn't even know what that was, you know, but I knew I'd been insulted, and I went across the street and I called the AA Central office. And I said, hi, this is June, I'm a member, and I've been fired. What are you going to do about it? I thought we'd pick it. You know, I'd never heard about anybody sober being fired. You know, you guys all got fired when you were drinking, but nobody gets fired sober. And I called my sponsor, and I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job. And sponsors are very important. Anyway, now I had to go out and look for another job, and I was out there looking for a job, and I swear I don't remember how this exactly happened, but I ended up filling out an application at a bank one day, and I could hardly contain my laughter as I filled it. I mean, having been a thief all my life, I just thought this was funny that I'd even be filling out an application. And I got to the part in the application where it says, due to the fact that as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check. I thought, oh no, not me. I don't want anybody looking into my background. I mean, first of all, they call one library, and I've had it. You know, But I thought, you know, why don't you do what the program's been telling you and do the footwork and leave the results up to God? And I did. And that's the first time I ever had done that part of the program. And I turned in the application, I got called back, and I got hired. I didn't just get hired to work in the bank. They put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if the program worked that good, you know. I was like, but it did. Somewhere in this period of time, I went to the International Young People's Conference, and I was 11 months sober, and it was held in San Francisco at a hotel called the St. Francis Hotel. And I'm not sure how many of you have been there. I haven't really seen it since, but I'll tell you my impressions of it. We drove up in a car, several of us, and pulled up outside, and I'd never really left Los Angeles in my life before I got sober, and I'd never been to San Francisco. And these people were going to park our car for us. I couldn't believe it. And
I'd never seen any place like this. It looked like a castle. There was velvet carpets and these real thick, velvet drapes and these real thick carpets, and everybody had gowns on and suits. And we got there and they go, okay, come on, let's go in. I said, uh-uh. I go, come on, June, the commission's in there. I'm not going in there. Because I knew that people like me didn't ever walk into a place like that. I knew if I walked in with my friends that somebody from the hotel would come over and say, I'm sorry, you'll have to leave. And I assure you I didn't look at all like I look tonight. They might have. But I just sat in the car and I cried. Because I knew that nice people like that could never have somebody like me who was just scum go into a nice place like that. And my friends finally came out at a couple of hours later and convinced me to come in. And I went in. And I went into the room. It's the only convention I've ever been to in my sobriety. I didn't attend one single meeting. I was too afraid to come out of my room. And I just sat in the room. And that's kind of the way that I felt about myself for an awful long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, it's just been a real slow kind of a thing. I worked in this bank. And when I finished working there, I'd been real ill since I'd come into the program. Because when I'd gotten off of the drugs and the alcohol, I'd had a lot more physical damage than I'd thought, and I was in and out of some hospitals and doctor's offices for quite a while, and I ended up getting laid off on a medical leave of absence from this job, and I got an opportunity to go to college. I got a loan. It was pretty small, and if I worked, I could do it, though, and I thought I'd like to try that, and I really don't know why I decided that, but I did. And for me, going to school was the first time I ever worked the program one day at a time, because really, in work, I wasn't very good at that, but for some reason in school, I was better able to do it. And I went to school every day, and I came home every night, and I did my homework, and then I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just did that one day at a time. And at the end of 2 years, I graduated from a city college with what they called an AA degree, which I thought was somewhat appropriate. And both of my sponsors were there. A couple members of my family and some real close friends of mine of Alcoholics Anonymous were there. And as I walked up to get my diploma, they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 500 people. Right. And as I walked up there, I knew that there was no way I had done that. There's no way I could have done that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't even read a sentence in the big book and remember it. So I knew that it wasn't me. I knew that it was only Alcoholics Anonymous that could have me walking up there to get that. And I decided at that time that I wanted to go ahead and keep going to school. And I applied to 5 universities. And I decided whichever one I got accepted in would be the one it was God's will for me to go to. And I got accepted at all 5. God wasn't going to make it any easy for me. And my sponsor and I talked about it, and he helped me narrow it down to 2, USC and UCLA. And then he told me that I would have to make the decision myself. And I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know where I was supposed to go, which one was the right one to go to. And I couldn't decide. And I was just desperate. And I heard about this thing called a God bag. And you just take a paper sack, and then you write down on separate pieces of paper all these solutions that could be possible to your problem. So I wrote down UCLA on one piece of paper and USC on another piece of paper, and I put them in this bag and I started shaking them up. And all my life I'd wanted to go to USC because I just loved football. And so I shook them up and I reached inside and I pulled out UCLA. So I thought 2 out of 3. And anyway, the God bag didn't work for me. As a matter of fact, there used to be a story that was real popular when I was new. This guy is walking along this cliff. And he falls. And as he falls, he's able to grab onto this little tiny branch. I mean, this is a very small branch. He can barely get both of his hands around it. And it's creaking as he holds on. It's obviously going to break. And he screams up to heaven. He says, God, if there is a God, do something. And this voice from up in the clouds says, do you really believe in God? And he says, yes. And the voice says, do you really believe in God? And he says, yeah. He says, come on, do something quick. I'm going to die here. And the voice says, if you really believe in God, you'll let go of the branch. And he's hanging on to this little branch, and he looks up at the voice, and he looks down, and it's a long, long way down. And he looks back up, and he says, anybody else up there? And there's been many times in Alcoholics Anonymous when I've been pretty sure what God's will was, but I was kind of hoping there might be something else still. Anyway, I went to UCLA, so maybe the God bag works better than I thought. And last year in June, I graduated from there. And again, you know, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you'd asked me if I wanted a college degree or a Harley Davidson, there would have been no contest. Believe me, I never wanted any part of this kind of a life, you know? I wanted to be tough, and I didn't want a college degree. And there I was. And somewhere in my life for my sobriety, I'd had this dream, and I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that a lot of dreams can come true. And all you have to do is try and do the footwork and see if that's what God wants to come true for you. And I went ahead and I did the footwork for this dream that I'd had. And, I guess about a year and a half ago, I got a letter telling me that 3,000 people had applied to UCLA's School of Law. And unfortunately, they could only accept 400. But that I'd been chosen as one of those. And, that's what I've been doing for the last year and a half. I've been going to law school. I assure you, when I came to the program, I'd always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table. It has not been easy, unlike the rest of school really was. It's been real hard for me. I worked last year, you know, in law school, and they say the first year is the worst, and I sure hope so, because it was pretty bad in a lot of ways. And I didn't do very well. And in May, I found out that I had gotten a D in a class, and it was real iffy whether I was going to have to retake a lot of my classes over. And I'd never done that badly in a class. And I thought maybe it meant that I wasn't supposed to go to law school. And I still don't know if that's what it meant. I've decided to stay. I did okay in all my other courses. I did average. And I'm not very good at doing average. I like to be the best. And anyway, so I've stayed in. And I've been back in school now for about 5 weeks in my second year. And it's been real interesting. You know, we're interviewing for jobs for next summer. They don't believe in one day at a time. And you know, they've already told me that I have to be practical and realize that with my grades, there's not much likelihood that I'll get offered a job with a firm. And some days I believe that, and I feel real inadequate, and I think I'm wasting my time. And other days I remember that if I'd have told them my story, they'd have said, you'll never get into UCLA Law School either. So I got to kind of remember that. I really believe, you know, that I'll be where I'm supposed to be, whether it be working in a firm or even being a lawyer. I don't know whether that's what I'm supposed to be doing, but I just want to go ahead and try whatever seems to be put in front of me. That's the way I've been the happiest and the way I've been the most comfortable, and that's what's in front of me right now. I think there's one other area I want to talk about for a couple minutes. Debbie, what time is it?
9:15.
Okay. I just want to talk about this for a little bit. I came into this program single. And if you do that, of course, when you're 13 years old, it's nice that you're still single, but when you do that and you hang around and you stay here, you know, sooner or later you're bound to go out on a date. It's just bound to happen. And I hate dating. I still do, really. I'd much rather fall in love. And I generally do. I'm the type of person that on the way to a coffee pot, I'll see someone and I'll fall in love. And if the next night he comes to the meeting with another woman, I think he's being unfaithful. And, however, if you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to date. I'm sorry. And it'll probably be an AA date. I don't know if you have those up here, but back home in AA dates where this guy takes you out and you go to a meeting. I mean, where else would you go, you know? And then after the meeting, you go to coffee and you talk about the meeting. And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. I take it this means we have some of those up here. I remember one night, this one had a peculiar twist. I was at the coffee stage of my date. And he said, you know, I really like you. And I said, well, thank you very much. He said, but I like your girlfriend at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her? And I said, why, no, not at all. And he did, and I went home and started to work the steps more diligently. I thought maybe it had to do with the steps or something, you know. And I thought it over, which, as I've already mentioned, is not really a good idea for me. I thought it over very carefully, and I came up with the only possible solution. And the next morning, I got up, and I went down and tried to join the United States Air Force. I figured, screw them, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me. So then I called my sponsor, which is what you should do. Right after the Air Force won't take you, you should call your sponsor. And I told my sponsor. I said, you know, it is not fair. Everybody in AA has a relationship but me. So I go to meetings, it's like Noah's Ark. They're arriving in pairs. You know? I can't stand it, you know. And I said, it's just not fair, you know. And he promised me that I was going to meet Prince Charming. And he said Prince Charming might even be on a white horse. And that the problem was, before I could meet Prince Charming, I had to kiss a lot of toads. And my best friend got me a giant poster with frogs on it that said that. And I hung it up in my bathroom. And I was able to just laugh, you know. And when somebody'd break my heart, I'd think, just another toad on the lily pad of life. And keep moving on. You know, I got sometimes I'd take out the 12 and 12 and read it. You might think that was a rather healthy thing to do, but certainly not the part that I had found, because the part that I had found talks about relationships, and it talks about it in the 12th step in the 12 and 12. And what it says in there is that many people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and upon getting sober, they're able to have reconciliations with the spouses that they were with before the program, and we find that these relationships are very successful. You think, that's great. And they said, now, some of these people are not able to have reconciliations. There's just been too much damage done. But oftentimes, they'll go on and meet somebody else within the program, and as long as both of these people have a firm spiritual foundation, we found that these relationships... We found that these relationships, too, can be successful. And you think, all right, that's fantastic. And then it says, however. There are those of us who are meant to live alone and give our lives to service here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you think, Jesus Christ. Why me? You know, I mean, I don't mind taking a newcomer. Anyway, my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous has had much the same dating experiences as I have. And we've discussed it, and we've learned a lot about acceptance in the program, and we've decided that we were the people that the big, you know, that the 12 and 12 is talking about, and that we're supposed to dedicate our lives to service. And we've decided to open up a 12-step house for men, and I'll send some flyers up here. Anyway, to get a little bit more on the serious side for a moment, in fact, despite my little dating escapades, or what you might call them, I really hung on in Alcoholics Anonymous to all of my old ideas for absolutely as long as I possibly could. I suppose many of us do that. For me, my old ideas consisted of primarily not caring about anybody else ever. And that particularly meant any kind of a male-female relationship. I didn't want to get close to anybody, and nobody was ever going to hurt me. I was never going to let anybody know that they'd gotten to me. And that's the way that I tried to maintain here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly never got close to people, and I didn't really get hurt in that respect for a long, long time. And when I was sober, I think 6.5 years, I fell in love. And I stupidly, in my opinion, let him know that I liked him, which was just unforgivable as far as I was concerned. And after about 30 days, he left me for a younger woman. And I was devastated, totally. Primarily, it was my pride or ego, because I'd never in my life told somebody I loved him, and then to be left and have him know that he had gotten me. It was just so obvious. And I didn't want anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous to know that he'd gotten me. Certainly not him, because he was also a member, and I didn't want him to find out that I'd cried in a meeting or that I'd mentioned that I was in pain, and so I didn't talk about it. And I didn't call my sponsor. And I didn't talk to anybody. And I certainly wasn't talking to God in any kind of a civil manner. I wanted to shut down emotionally. And what I learned, I went into depression for a long time. It's the only depression I've ever had in my life, really. Since sober, anyway. And what I found out was that I had to make a very important decision. One that maybe all of us have to make. I don't know. But the decision for me was that if I wanted to be the person that I'd always wanted to be when I was out there on the streets, to not care, to not get close to people, to never let anybody hurt me, that I could. But that the only way I could be that person was to use drugs and alcohol. That was the only way I ever could be that person. It was the only way I ever could shut down emotionally the way I wanted to do. And that if I didn't want to go back to that way of life, but instead wanted to stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous with the life that you people were trying to teach me, that I was going to have to do it your way. That I was going to go ahead and have to get my feelings hurt sometimes, and be sensitive sometimes, and be vulnerable sometimes, and be soft or kind, all the things I've always hated and despised. And then I could stay sober. But that those were very simply the choices that I had available to me. That there was no way I could continue to try and be the person I'd always wanted to be and stay sober. The pain was just too much. I couldn't do it. And I decided that I was willing to go ahead and live life on your terms. To go out there and be a normal human being and to get hurt sometimes. And to let people know if that happened to be the case. And in fact, what happened was, not too long after that, I fell in love. And I got engaged to be married. And that had never happened before. And I had an absolutely wonderful time with a wonderful man. And we broke up. And really, a wonderful thing happened, you know. I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror, which is one of the most neurotic things that I've ever done. And all my life I've done it. Whenever anybody has ever walked out of my life or died or anybody has ever gone, I've always looked in the mirror and I've said, look at you. Look at what you are. Look at where you've been, and you wonder why they left. You wonder why anybody would leave you. You should be lucky they would stay and tolerate you as long as they did. You should be grateful that anybody would have anything to do with you. And I tried to do that this time when this guy and I broke up. I went and I tried to run the same tape on myself, and it just wasn't true anymore. I couldn't say it anymore, because I'm not that person. I like the person that I am today most of the time. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no way anybody could ever, ever convince me that I would want to be me. Not for 5 seconds. Most of all, that I would ever want to feel like me. And I do. And I live a very incredible life. There's no way that a person like me, who comes from where I came from, can be living the life that I am living. And sometimes I forget that, you know. Sometimes I think, well, actually, maybe drinking was a phase that I went through, you know. Maybe I was sowing my wild oats. And I'm obviously very bright. I mean, I've made it into law school. I'm obviously very intelligent, and maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. And all I have to do, I found 2 things that are very successful for me. One is reading the 3rd chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it talks about more about alcoholism, and that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday he will control and enjoy his drinking, knowing that there's no way I've ever been able to do both at the same time. I also live very close to Venice, where I did my drinking and using. And I can go down there without having to be dramatic or exaggerate. I can tell you what happened to the women that I used to drink and use drugs with. There isn't one of them that I know of that's left. They're all either dead, they're locked up in an institution, or they're out on the streets turning tricks to support the habit that they have. Most of them live with a man who beats them up on a regular basis. They don't have a whole lot of furniture in their house. They never have the gas, the lights, and the phone on at the same time. And they have bugs and rats that live in their house. And you know why I know that? Because that's where I came from. That's the life that I was living before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I grew up. And you know where I'm supposed to be tonight? Right down there with them. And you know why I'm not? Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you. If you're new, give us a chance to do the same for you. Thank you for inviting me.